From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. When Blake Spaulding and Jennifer Castle wrote their first cookbook, their restaurant, Hell's Backbone Grill, was only 4 years old, but already it was getting national attention for its food and its sensibility. When they arrived in Boulder in 2000, they had a vision for what they wanted to do. The idea was serve locally sourced, seasonal, farm-to-table food. But they were full of apprehension about how they would be received in a small, rural, mostly Mormon community. They wanted to be respectful, but they also wanted to be themselves. So they had to find a balance. Now, 17 years later, it seems to have gone pretty well. They've stayed in Boulder, the place continues to get attention, and now they have a new cookbook with new recipes and new insights for food and community. Blake and Jennifer are joining us today. We hope you will too, after the news. This week on Radio West Films, we have the latest short in our series on Gerda Saunders. A few years ago, Gerda learned she had a progressive form of dementia, and she's allowed us to follow her on this journey. But this latest film is not about Gerda so much. It's about Peter, her husband of 46 years. Because at some inevitable point, the story always shifts away from the person with dementia to the person watching them live through it. Go see it at radiowest.org. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Blake Spaulding and Jennifer Castle moved from Flagstaff, Arizona to Boulder, Utah in 2000 to open a restaurant. They were incredibly excited about the adventure. As they explained in their first cookbook, they had been given this chance to go far away from everyone they knew to this isolated location to cook and put their ideas about food and life into practice. But they were outsiders, and they were anxious about how they would be received in a very small, very rural, very Mormon community. The trick was to be respectful of the locals, but not so ingratiating that they lost their own identity or compromised their principles about food and food justice. As they wrote in that first cookbook, how could we strike a balance between who we were as people and what we wanted our neighbors to know of us? Well, a lot of you know the end of that story by now. The restaurant, Hell's Backbone Grill, has become nationally recognized. It's become Hell's Backbone Grill and Farm, a farm with 65 fruit trees, 150 chickens, full-time farmhands, dozens of employees. It might even be fair to say they're no longer outsiders, though I'd like to hear what they have to say about that. Blake and Jennifer have a new cookbook to celebrate 18 seasons in Boulder, and today in the program they're joining us to talk about what they've learned about farming and building a community on the edge of the wilderness. The book is called This Immeasurable Place, Food and Farming from the Edge of the Wilderness. And Blake Spaulding and Jen Castle are joining us here in the studio. And welcome to you both. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, Doug. So nice to be here with you.
Good morning.
I want to ask about Boulder. When, I don't know this story, actually. I mean, I heard some of the stories. When did you, who first saw Boulder first?
That was Blake.
Yeah.
Yeah. Actually, it's so long ago now, I don't remember. I think it was you, Jen.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, what would you, I guess first impressions of the place. Like, did you think, oh, this is a magical, amazing place, or it was just something that you drove through? I mean, what was the first impressions?
I guess I would say both Jen and I kind of met through the Grand Canyon River community. We were both cooks in Grand Canyon. And so we sort of already knew the power of wilderness and a decent meal.
Yeah.
And so, you know, there were very few things that could have pried us out of that life. But, you know, the opportunity to live in a place that's as beautiful and as remote and as majestic as Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument is was absolutely compelling. And we just thought, hey, this could work, you know, and we'd been river cooks. So also we were like, it doesn't really matter that it's remote because there's running water, electricity, and a roof.
That's all we need.
Yeah, yeah, we'll be fine. We can figure it out.
But what did you think that in those early days, before you had actually put pen to paper and said, oh, restaurant, right? Were you looking for a place?
No, it was almost like the place was looking for us. Huh. I don't know. It was weirdly kismet. You know, there was this beautiful building that was standing empty, and
in Boulder. And who first encountered that building? Like, what is that building doing?
Well, that would have been me.
Yeah.
And so Jen saw it first, in that she'd been to Boulder before I had, and had a sense of how amazing it was. But the building was empty, and the people who owned the lodge were looking for some intrepid, foolish people who would be willing to start it and a new restaurant there. And so we basically borrowed $3,000 and got a year's free rent. And we were like, let's try it for a year and see if we can pull it off.
Yeah. What was the idea? I'm guessing you're like, oh, it was a restaurant. That's a pretty simple. But was it bigger than that? Like, we're thinking of a restaurant, but we have a bigger concept in mind.
That's a great question. We definitely had a bigger concept in mind. And Jen and I had been doing extreme catering, like in the early days of reality TV. So also we had done some work together in the wilderness beyond Grand Canyon. I think our bigger idea was that if you create a warm hearth next to a place of wilderness, that what might occur for people is a transformational experience, because people need to feel comfort going in and then to feel comfort coming out of a transformational wilderness experience. And so that was one of our core values. I would say the other was both Jen and I had traveled a lot when we were younger, and, you know, you go to a place like Italy, and you're going to not eat New Zealand lamb in Italy. You're going to eat Italian lamb and Italian ham and Italian jam. And so we wanted to find a way to celebrate the place through food, where people were developing like a literal, visceral connection through the intimate act of taking the place into their bodies through nourishment. And so we wanted to create that kind of menu. So, for example, we've never served, you know, seafood in our restaurant because it's not of the place.
Yep.
So we got busy right away making a garden. And then as our business grew, we eventually realized we needed a proper farm.
Yeah.
And so we added that in 2005. And and so I guess the other core value would be everything made on site with love, with attention and care. I'm Buddhist, and Jen's kind of a Buddhist enabler. She likes to call herself.
Yeah, I love it. She's the enabler.
Yeah, and so she's like, sure, we can do it like that. You know, she's great.
Whatever. I just want to cook.
Yeah, she's an amazing, amazing cook, and so we collaborate on menu ideas and recipe ideas, and then Jen, you know, turns them into food for the masses. So
I want to go back to when, and I know you've told this story, but you haven't told it to me. So when you were driving into Boulder for the first time, and you are, what, are you nervous? I know you're excited. As I mentioned in the introduction, you're super excited, but you're also pretty anxious. And you had sort of, you laid out, as I understand it, you talk about this in your first book, how are we going to engage with the locals? What are they going to make? But would you take me through that? Just like how you were thinking about all of that at that time.
Yeah, well, I guess also because Jen and I had traveled to remote places, we sort of had the idea, like, we're both big believers in having good manners. So there was that, you know, just to try to be kind and warm. And, you know, we wanted to live somewhere where we had friends and where we were liked. And so we started by having an open house where we made a lot of the dishes that we planned to serve in the restaurant. So before we opened the doors to the public, we invited the local community to come to a party at our place.
But what did you know about Mormons?
Oh.
Or rural country folk? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I would guess that I didn't really know much. You know, I had ideas. And, you know, one of the Buddhist kind of rules, if you will, you know, vows you make, is never to judge anyone else's spiritual path. And so, you know, I wanted to have an open mind about what would be a very different spiritual tradition than mine. Jen grew up kind of quasi-Catholic, you know, and so I think we...
But I'm trying to figure out, okay, what part of you, there's the Buddhist part of you that's like, hey, they're all on a spiritual path and I'm going to just embrace that. But how much of that was nervous that you were, as you explain in your book, rough-talking, assertive females worried about going into a Mormon environment that maybe treats women as second-class citizens. You know, you can't curse. There wasn't a liquor license in the place before you guys got
correct.
There. So, I mean, how much of that was making you nervous?
You know, I'm not really sure. Do
really?
You, Jen? Do you have?
I kind of do.
Yeah.
We had a 16-year-old server working with us, and her mom was the postmaster, mistress. And they were the first little LDS family who welcomed us in, and they were just so nice to us all the time. And I had lived and went to school with Mormons in Flagstaff, Cherry Hill, Mormon Hill.
Yeah.
It wasn't like another culture, but knowing that we were going to this town of 200 people, the 200 were another culture, whether they were LDS or not, you know?
Sure.
And like you say, kind of like, is it going to be rough ranching cow people or what is it?
Yeah.
But asking this girl we worked with, Jen, if I wear a tank top to the post office, is your mom going to think I'm slutty? And she's like, oh, Jen, we're taught not to judge other people. My mom thinks you're great.
Yeah.
And I was like, this is the kind
totally
of religious people I love, you know? And if this is what we're in for, then, and it's not, but it was a really good setup for me to just fall in love with them and kind of let some of that fear go, where we're going to be friends. We're going to like each other. We're going to respect each other. And maybe I'll wear a tank top to the post office, and maybe I won't.
Yeah.
And maybe I'm a, yeah.
But I love how you actually deal with this. You go full on in the first book and in the second book. And at first it's like, all right, how do we find that balance? And in the second book, you talk about the country manners. This is what it's like. Now, it's funny because now you're insiders. Now you're like, this is how we're going to treat you.
Close the gate.
Right? Close the damn gate. Tell someone if you've gone hiking. Lift I know this because my family grew up in rural Utah, so I know the lift the finger on the steering wheel is a wave. They totally do that. You mentioned that. Don't be in a rush, you say. Was that something you had to figure out, or were you naturally not in a rush? But that's the one thing that seems like is true about rural people. They're not in a rush.
Yeah, I think, the reason we started playing with the country manners piece because, you know, it was sort of like, what would we wished we would have known,
yeah,
you know, when we moved here, like if we could have had someone give us 10 pieces of advice. And I think the 10 pieces of advice or so approximately that we give is more like, it was sort of meant to be helpful as well as a little bit like give a snapshot into sort of the culture and custom of the place. And the don't be in a rush is a really big one. Like, I see that that's really where people let themselves get frustrated in our environment. You know, like they want their food right away. And we're like, well, you know, we make everything to order. It's not fast food. Or they get frustrated if we're 5 minutes behind, you know, in a reservation. And, you know, they're like, well, we made a reservation. I'm like, right. But see, there's no table right now.
Yeah.
So you get to sit and wait and try to enjoy yourself, you know, while you do it. And it's sort of a good antidote to modern day urban culture where everybody's like rage driving and, you know, like,
yeah.
I almost got in a car accident coming up here because someone, I don't know why, but they just got, yeah, ragey with me and zoomed around. I was going the same speed as everybody, but anyway.
I can't imagine being ragey once you drop in to Boulder from that magnificent highway, though. Like,
yeah.
It seems impossible that someone,
you know,
is ragey at
think,
that point.
But then
get stuck behind one cattle drive.
I was going to just say, the local ranchers, you know, the custom and culture of the place is they drive the cows down the middle of the road. It's a two-lane road, and you have to just you know, push through slowly and wait. And people do get kind of, they get wound up about it. It's funny.
My first few cattle drives, like heading to work and coming from Flagstaff where it's 100 trains a day. So you're always stuck behind a train. It's a good excuse. And this was like, oh my gosh, we're stuck behind cows. Still. It's kind of weird. And then we have a fridge at work where it like vapor locks when you shut it, and everyone just tries to ram it open. And I'm like, this is where you take a breath. And I make them like look at the ceiling and reset with their chin. And by the time they're done taking a breath, the fridge will open again. Yeah. So we try to bring it into the workplace.
And everything about your place is trying to find the place to be centered, right?
Well, because what's the option? Exactly. You know, the alternative.
Jen's more Buddhist than she realizes.
Yeah, you probably, it sounds like you are. You described the place in the new book as a place so microscopic that anonymity and complacence are all but outlawed. Talk about that, because I like this idea that you can't, in a small place where there's 200 people or whatever it is now, you can't really be complacent. You can't just be a part, which I think is surprising in some ways. I'm sure there are, but that was an interesting way of putting it.
Yeah, I mean, in a way, Jen and I have talked about this a lot over the years. It almost seems to me now like humans, from the standpoint of evolution, are designed to live in villages of about 300 people because there's a way in which it fast-tracks you on a growth path, or it fast-tracks you, sadly, on a bad path. You know, and we see it with new employees that come, you know, where they either discover who they are and they get known for their positive qualities and they really shine. And this would, I guess, also apply to people who move to Boulder, you know, whether they work for us or not. Or, you know, they tend to, you know, really run into difficult places in themselves and they will, you know, make up a big story about how they hate it or hate us or whatever and leave in a hurry. You know, and I think what it is like if you are a person who is fundamentally kind in a town of 300 people, you quickly get known for that. If you're a person who's fundamentally impatient and in a hurry, that's your hallmark. And it's really uncomfortable if that's not how you want to be known. In a city, you can change your job, you can move to a different neighborhood, you can get away from your shadow. In a community this size, your only option is to deal with your shadow or to leave the community. So if you're someone who's by nature really lazy, everyone's going to know it within a year. And that's painful. It's really painful. So you can either get busy not being lazy and, you know, get known for
something else,
self-improvement, or you get stuck with that. And I think it's really good for human beings. If you flip someone off in an intersection, it will haunt you for 20 years. You know, you'll always be known as the person that did that. And it's very uncomfortable. And it's also really important, I think, for civil society that, you know, you don't have the anonymity and you are known by your actions.
Jen, are you surprised that you stayed as long as you did in Boulder?
I totally am.
Yeah.
Yeah, I thought it would be 3 years. I had committed to 3 years. And then...
And then what did you figure after that? You just go find another place?
Yeah, I wanted to do some kind of other work. We had done this reality TV stuff, and I thought I could go to Seattle and get involved with a production company and just do that kind of work. Wasn't really sure what that meant, but I had three friends who were going to show me.
Yeah.
You know? And I'd been cooking and smelling like garlic and bread flour for a long time and working at 2 a.m. And that when Blake and I sat and talked about this, she's like, you'll never have to work at 2 a.m. again. I was like, well.
Which is almost
there's
true.
An appeal to that. It's just that it's 7 days a week.
Yeah.
No, never at 2 a.m. Just never days off. No. I didn't know I'd stay that long. And a lot of people worried. I was 28. They're like, what are you going to do? Like, you're just going to. You're going to lose. I don't know. You're going to lose everything. Or. I'm not sure what they thought. I didn't know what I was thinking, except that what a great adventure, and with this cool person in this cool place doing what we want with no one to tell us how to do it.
Do you remember a point at which you thought, I'm going to stay, like making the decision, I'm here. This is, I guess, home.
Mm-hmm. I don't remember when. It was either year 7 or year 9. I think it was year 9.
Really? Wow.
And I was on the phone. I was here in Salt Lake at an intersection and talking to my girlfriend. And she was in Phoenix with her husband and 3 children. And I was like, man, it's just all I do is work. And I live in this tiny town. I haven't left town since 3 months ago. And I'm here. Like, I have to go to Costco. And she's just like, oh, Jen, you're not at home with 4 boys in your house. Bloom where you're planted. And I was like, whoa. It just felt really profound, this moment of where she feels trapped and she has this big, beautiful life that I haven't seen and I feel trapped. And the only choice is to embrace it and just get in, because this is it. What are you going to do? So that stuck with me. And I have recommitted myself to blooming where I'm planted.
Do you guys feel like you're not outsiders anymore?
That's an interesting question. I mean, you know, we have lived there now 18 years.
Yep.
And so I guess I don't feel like an outsider. Like, the place is us and we are the place. And, you know, we've certainly had, for better or worse, a big influence on the place. But, you know, I guess, I mean, sadly, I guess this launches us, this conversation, in a little bit of a different direction. But, you know, with the change, proposed change in the monument, and all of the kind of subsequent drama around that impending loss, I would say the sort of, unfortunately, some of the culture war stuff that was active when we moved there is now, unfortunately, reactivated.
It's
and
back.
So there's a bit, it had all really died down, and I felt like everyone was getting along great and things were going really well. Our town is thriving.
Yeah.
But now there's some tribal sort of us versus them stuff again. And I have seen recently some things like, basically, that anyone who came after the monument was declared in 1996 is, you know, sort of unwelcome again, which is heartbreaking because we were, I think, really thriving, all of us. And one of the things that we did, you know, when we first came there was one of our sort of ideas about how to become part of the community was to really offer jobs to any teenagers that sincerely wanted to learn how to work. Because I started working in a kitchen for pay when I was 12. And so I think, you know, jobs training work for youth is really, really important. And it's harder to do these days, but where we are, it was possible. And so we hired children of, you know, the Mormon community, the ranchers, and we got to be close with the families through that process, because we genuinely loved their children and their children genuinely loved us back. And so there was some real positivity that came forward with that. So we are, I would say, still in the eyes of most of the local ranchers, certainly any of them that whose children worked with us, they still love us.
Yep.
And we've kind of had to agree to disagree.
Yeah.
And I would like to say that we're not outsiders anymore, but I'm afraid it's all just shifted.
Are you worried about it, Jen, that part of it?
I am, but I don't really know. I don't know what more to say about that.
I mean, I think that it seems like after the election, when Donald Trump won, I think for a lot of people, they made this assessment of the people close to them and felt like that people who had voted for Donald Trump, or on the other side of it, people who had voted for Hillary Clinton, that revealed something about them that they couldn't trust anymore. And that changed things. Mm. And I'm wondering if you see that in the people you mentioned the culture war thing. It seems like it is back in a way. And I wonder, Blake, if you see that people feeling suspicious now, maybe bumper stickers that you wouldn't have seen before or language that you wouldn't have heard before. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. In Boulder, not so much. Yeah. Because, again, there's that community of 300 where it's more, there's more sort of, at least face-to-face, it's more respectful.
Yeah.
I mean, Jen and I, we're...
Yeah, because you're forced to be right there.
Yeah, that's true. So you can't, there's not the anonymity that you get on the web or in a city. Jen and I are huge Hillary Clinton lovers. Like, she's definitely like one of our greatest heroes in life. And so we were pretty excited and we put up our Hillary signs and we were like, we may get some pushback, but nobody pushed back. And we had a few conversations with some of our employees whose families perhaps were excited about Trump. And, you know, they were like, it's cool. We know who you are. You know, like they weren't, you know, I'm thinking of Amelia, you know, and they weren't unkind to us about it. You know, they just kind of accept us for who we are.
Yeah.
And so in Boulder, I would say not so much. In our county, absolutely, there's some really angry rhetoric, and certainly our county commissioners really dislike Jen and I, and that's really uncomfortable because I've been extremely vocal and, you know, focused on trying to get the word out that there's only a small percentage of locals who are actually against the monument. It's just they're particularly loud, and they happen to be in public office. And, you know, in our county, Garfield County is really remarkable in that it's the size of Delaware. It's 5,000 square miles, and there's only 5,000 people who live there. And so when you talk about locals are against the monument, you're talking about like, okay, maybe there's 600 people in the county that are against the monument. And so it's really, it's been really disheartening to see kind of the rhetoric and the idea that the locals hate the monument, because it's not so. I'm a local. I love the monument. All of the people who work in our restaurant, you know, many of them have bought land and started families. They've met their spouse working at the restaurant, therefore the monument. And even like a good percentage of the local Mormon community is for the monument. So, you know, that part, there is some unfortunate sort of ugliness that's coming out of, I'm just going to go ahead and call him out, Leland Pollack's mouth, you know, and Mike Noel. They don't like Jen and I. And they
didn't like us before.
That's true. They would never eat in our restaurant. They haven't eaten, you know.
At all, ever.
Never, no. So they've kept the culture wars alive, waiting for this moment where maybe they can get retribution for what they perceive as a harm that was done to them in 1996 with the declaration of the monument. So now the fires in their hearts are burning very bright, and they are just, they're saying whatever they want. And it's been uncomfortable. I mean, we're under an extremely comprehensive state audit right now, for state sales tax. That's a scope of which even attorneys haven't heard of before. And so it feels punitive, and we're going to do what we can to survive it, but it's been crazy. So, you know, like, there's definitely some stuff going on.
It's Blake Spaulding alongside Jen Castle. She's the chef owner of Hell's Backbone Grill and Farm in Boulder, Utah. The restaurant is currently closed for the season. You probably know that. They'll be open again in March 16th. They have a new book. It's called This Immeasurable Place. It's already sold out, we have to say. They're currently taking pre-orders for the second printing, which should be available in February. You can get information by going to our website, radiowest.org. We're going to take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the story of the Hell's Backbone Grill. It's one of the West's best farm-to-table restaurants. You can find it comfortably settled in rural Utah, in Boulder. Blake Spaulding and Jen Castle came to Boulder in 2000. They wanted to test out this vision to serve locally sourced, seasonal farm-to-table food, but also become a fixture of the community. They're with us today to talk about their new book. It's called This Immeasurable Place. They're joining us here in the studio. So I want to talk about regional food and how you figured out what that meant in Boulder. So it's interesting. You talk about in the book that when you arrived, Utah was known for certain things. So what is the stuff that, but also not known exactly for its cuisine or anything like that. So what did you take from the place? I know the Mormon Pioneer recipes were something that you were really drawn to. And the Western Range cowboy fare is another thing that you really took to. How did you adapt your own ideas of food with what you were seeing in Boulder to make that part of your food?
Yeah, that basically we just brainstormed. We kind of came up with a palette, if you will, of ingredients that could or would or historically were grown in our area. So, you know, Boulder is very, it's high altitude, we're at almost 7,000 feet, but it's covered in historic heirloom orchards, fruit trees, grapevines, there's sagebrush and juniper trees everywhere. And then it's, you know, got a great culture of cattle and cattle grazing and ranching, and then sheep, and then trout. And so we kind of were like, what naturally occurs here? And then we ran it kind of through a prism or kaleidoscope of what we imagined Four Corners cuisine would be. So taking influences from, you know, the ancestral Puebloan diet and food that is there, corn and pine nuts and like that. And then also just regular Southwestern flavors. Jen grew up in Albuquerque and her grandma's old New Mexican. So she grew up making pozoles and tamales and delicious things with chilies. And then, really a deep bow of respect and appreciation for pioneer and Western Range food, you know, cowboy cooking and Mormon cultural food. Because, you know, while people may poke fun at Mormon,
casseroles and things,
actually they are, you know, out of that tradition came extraordinary food, you know, beautiful, really imaginative food that comes from your pantry, not from what you can go get. Yeah. And it comes from a tradition of farming and gardening and putting things up. So we started pickling and fermenting right away when we got there, because once you have a garden of any size, you realize basically all your tomatoes are going to come ripe in a week.
Yeah.
So you can't only serve tomatoes in a restaurant. You have to, you know, for that week, you have to have other things, and then you want tomatoes for later.
Yep.
And so we have a rule, we don't really buy tomatoes out of season, but we have, you know, we roast them and freeze them and we dry them and we jar them and like that, you know. So anyway, kind of, and then when we added the farm, then we were really in the soup, because then, you know, literally and figuratively, we can easily have 7,000 pounds of winter squash come in over the course of 2 days, and we have to figure out what in the world to do with it that's, you know, not going to bore our guests that are there for 4 days. Maybe they don't only want to eat winter squash that week. So we have to figure out creative ways, just like the pioneers did, to save and stretch and preserve and then showcase.
When you were deciding the food you wanted in the new book, did you have a philosophy? Just like, oh, that's good, people really love that, or let's try this, or let's. Fish. So, how did you decide for the new one? What to put in and what you wanted to include?
Well, with this book, we were kind of, our first book was sort of a micro look at community, and it was very tightly focused in. Like, it was about our, you know, our integration, and so. At that time, we were just like, what recipes do we think people want? You know, we were so new to the process. This one kind of was born out of the plenitude that comes from the farm. So the general theme of the recipes are things that have some connection to the farm. There's a few notable exceptions where people were just like, you have to put this recipe in.
Like, or, what? Like what?
The lemony club.
I was going to say
no,
that.
No, that doesn't have...
Explain what that is.
I mean, we grow the shallots, yeah. So that's real. But everything else, it's just a really... It's like, Jen and my favorite comfort food mixed in a dish that's... Like, my staff teases me because I basically eat it 5 nights a week still. I'm like, I don't want to take it off the menu because it's my favorite thing.
Because you want to eat it.
Yeah, it's just a really, just a beautiful chicken and rice dish that's really bright with lemon and shallots and white wine and a lot of butter.
And you'd be surprised to find how hard it is to find chicken with skin. Like, that was the goal. We wanted skin on the chicken.
Yeah, of course.
And it's almost impossible. Everybody wants these, like, sterile, freaky little breasts with spelled B-R-E-S-T. Like, they don't even spell it because it's not a real thing.
Yeah.
And so we hack up 32 chickens a couple times a week and take off the meat and keep all the skin and then use all the other parts around the restaurant.
Although there's no chick, you know, we don't source our own chickens. So we buy.
Wait, I thought you had 150 chickens.
We do, but they're only for
that would
eggs.
Last a week.
Yeah, that's true, right?
Yeah.
I guess that's right. Yeah,
we source our chicken through Mary's Chicken, which is kind of the preeminent pastured chicken program in the United States.
How do you guys, I don't want to put you on the spot on this one, but I know you have this ethic, no harm. You're not even swatting flies. We're going to find something to do with this mouse we caught and we'll take them somewhere else.
Live trapping skunks.
Live trapping. But then how does that go with the idea and how are you thinking, like, philosophically about meat?
Yeah, well, I mean, this is a nuanced and complex question, so it might take me a minute.
Go for it.
Yeah,
and
so,
honestly, I'm not putting you on the spot.
Yeah, no, I don't feel on
it.
The spot.
Oh, good,
it's a really important conversation to have.
And you can eat the flies when you catch them.
Yeah.
If you do.
That's what we tell the staff.
We tell the staff, like, if you're hungry and you want to eat
don't waste them.
But don't waste it.
Don't kill them just
don't
for sport.
Don't kill something just because it's inconvenient. You know, it loves its body, you know, and so there's that, like a fly, you know, if we had the opportunity to zoom around for 30 seconds in a fly's body and see what it sees, we would never again relate to that fly as just something that, to kill out of hand. You know, every act we do as humans, you know, we're in a interdependent world. So whether you're driving your car and all the bugs are piling up on your windshield, or you're digging in the ground to plant potatoes, you know, you're unfortunately disrupting somebody else's life, you know, and so whether you're, no matter what you're doing, you're going to cause somebody harm as a human, you know, because we have to eat to survive. And, you know, one of the things that's very real is that in order for, let's say, farm soil to be healthy, it needs animal inputs. So there has to be manure, there has to be bone meal or feather meal, unless you're doing conventional farming where you're doing, you know, petrochemical poisons as your inputs, you need animal inputs. And so even if you're vegan, if you're eating organically, you're still relying on animals. And that's just something you understand if you've ever had a farm. You can do crop rotation, which we do. You can do things that are like Epsom salts or magnesium inputs, but you have to have manure. And so I think it's really important to only eat animals that have, a quality animal life with friends under a blue sky with access to clean water and shade trees on pasture, feet on the ground. When Jen and I leave our little realm, I often revert to vegetarianism because I don't want to eat factory tortured animals. And so there's a qualitative difference that doesn't often get talked about, which is why this is such a nuanced conversation. If we all collectively stopped eating cows and were to become vegetarian, we would have a real issue insofar as how to grow organic food, because nobody keeps cows around unless they're eventually going to be used for some kind of either dairy or beef. Yeah. And if you're going to have a dairy cow, you have to have the dairy cow get pregnant and have give birth to freshen up their capacity to give milk. And so, like everything, you know, there's a lot of complexity. And for Jen and I, we have an extraordinary woman rancher, Katie Coleman, who we feature in our book, who loves her cows very deeply and has a connection. And she's not just like, she takes amazing care of them and they're happy. And then when it's time for them to go, it's tender for her and yeah. It's tender for us. And we thank the animal. I get beat up a lot for talking about this stuff because some people see it as hypocritical, but my first Buddhist teacher, Chagda Tukul Rinpoche, taught really like you can give up eating meat for the benefit of all beings, or you can give up eating vegetables for the benefit of all beings, because every time you plow a field, you're killing countless beings. You know, every time you dig in the soil to plant a tomato plant, micro beings are harmed. There is no way around the fact that we cause harm as we grow and produce our food and eat. I think what really matters is that we accept that truth, yeah. And we try to bring as much consciousness and love and kindness to whatever it is that we're doing with any sentient beings as humanly possible. And it's really a very personal decision.
That's Blake Spaulding along with Jen Castle. They're chefs and owners of Hell's Backbone Grill and Farm. They have a new book. It's called This Immeasurable Place. I'm afraid it's already sold out, but they're taking pre-orders for the second printing. You can get information about it on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a quick break and come back for some final thoughts in just a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio, back now with Blake Spaulding and Jen Castle. They are the owners and chefs at Hell's Backbone Grill and Farm in Boulder. They have a new book, which already sold out. They're getting new copies made for February. It's called This Immeasurable Place, Food and Farming from the Edge of the Wilderness, and they're joining us in the studio to talk about it. Jen, what's your favorite thing to cook in this book? Is that unfair? Like, is there one that you...
I don't know. I love
really?
Making staff meal every day. Like, I go into the fridge and make just a jumble for lunch for the 40 of us.
Wait, what do you love about it? Just the idea of improvising and finding
the
what's there.
Mystery basket.
Yeah.
You know, and like, why is this bacon still here? And who burned the mashed potatoes or whatever? Like, finding the weird stuff and like cleaning it. And then... a lot of it'll be kind of New Mexican, just like something really mellow, tacos or burritos, but everybody goes crazy. And it's so fun to have the farmers who've been outside all day and even the morning staff who've been picking at scrambled eggs all morning or whatever. There just makes them really happy. It's, I don't know.
It seems
really
like
cute.
That's part of a philosophy. I mean, I found it in the way you write about things, the idea of, I don't know if it's Buddhist or just the idea of improvising, the idea of variety. Mm. Like you can't make the same pot of soup.
My teacher always says you think you have the same coffee every morning, but it's never the same, you know, and the same with the soup. Jen, I would say, like, she makes this amazing pozole. So the juniper lamb pozole that's in the winter section of the book is she made it the other day, and I couldn't believe how good it was. I was so happy with it. And then we have a dish there that we call a genchilada instead of an enchilada, and Jen makes amazing red chili, and that's a breakfast dish. And but we had a lot of fun putting these recipes together. You know, I wanted to say that the title of the book, This Immeasurable Place, was kind of, when we started the book 5 years ago, we were like, what's the story we want to tell now, you know? Yeah. And we really wanted to talk about what it's been like to live and work on the edge of just such vast, untrammeled wilderness, you know, because it's just, it's such a magnificent place. But then we were like, well, let's kind of do a macro micro. So that there's sort of a theme of that in the book, close up of a cabbage and then a zoom out of the landscape looking at the farm. And then the immeasurable part also refers to the four immeasurable qualities in Buddhism. And we try to bring that to all of our interactions with our staff, our guests, ourselves. We aspire. I wouldn't say we succeed because then we'd be enlightened, and we sure aren't, you know. But, you know, I think with this book, we really tried to just hit the sweet spot of recipes that we thought people would enjoy making at home. And then also, like, recipes that we felt like would be helpful to people.
Yeah.
One of the really primary values that Jen and I have in the restaurant is to not waste food. And so we have this really complicated system with buckets. And so, you know, one of the great things about our 150 chickens is they eat all the plate scraps. So none of the what our customers don't eat gets carefully scraped into buckets and delivered to the chickens in the morning. And but even, you know, like we buy our cows whole, and so we save the bones and we make bone broth, and that is a base. And Jen and I love the bone broth, and so that's at the sort of towards the end of the book, and that's just a great thing to do if you ever need something nourishing and comforting.
Yeah.
Yeah, everything in here I like to cook.
Yeah,
I'm just going, Jen's going through all the stuff. Like, everything's really good.
Well, it's good, but I love eggs. So we have the bacon and egg salad with the warm mustard dressing. I love the egg pasta. Yeah. I love the shirred eggs.
Shirred eggs, I think that's one of my favorites.
I love the mayonnaise. I love the risotto stuffed poblano. Yeah, it's all, and I mean, I like steps and processes and the tamales de maris, I love that. That's some weird tamale wrapped in grape leaf thing.
I love that idea.
Yeah. Oh, there it is.
There it is. So one of the things, I guess, Bruce Babbitt writes a foreword in the book, and he writes about the role that the role of the Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument and how that has it's played a part in the restaurant and the farm, you're thinking. I mean, the monument was really critical in some ways to you beginning the restaurant and the farm, I think. So now that President Trump has proposed drastically cutting back the acreage, stripping it away, recalling it a different thing, how does that change your sense of place right now?
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, we sort of jokingly call ourselves a monumental business. You know, our business wouldn't have existed if it weren't for the original designation of the monument. And, you know, we're in turmoil right now. We're part of a lawsuit with Grand Staircase Escalante Partners. We're affiants. We're hopeful that this isn't, you know, that what's been proposed won't come to fruition, but it's very much shifting sands right now. And, you know, there's this national park proposal for right where we are, which we want to be clear we're very, very much against. It's important to us that the monument remain intact. I think we would never have gone there without the monument. And we're there for the monument. You know, our land is really our brand. And our great wish is that the monument remains intact and gets properly funded again so that some of the complaints that the local ranchers have about, you know, reduced forage and so forth can be addressed within the BLM's management plan, because that's, you know, when the monument was originally declared in 1996, it had a $16 million operating budget. and now we're down to 4 million, and there's just no, that's not enough for an area that big, 1.9 million acres. You know, as the monument reduction has been proposed, I've tried to keep track of all of it, and it's very confusing. And then Chris Stewart put forth this proposal to turn part of it into a park. But what I have sort of heard is that the real reason behind the park proposal, the national park, is that if Congress is somehow tricked into passing that, then it redraws the lines of the monument in a way that will throw out the five lawsuits. And so it's very, very important that everyone call their representatives and say they don't want the park. And I would say if they have a connection to any representatives anywhere in the country, you know, that might be tricked into thinking that somehow this is a happy, friendly, bipartisan thing that they could get done before the holidays, to let them know that people in Utah don't want this, at least most of us.
What's it like in Boulder in the winter?
It's magnificent. It's quiet. It's our favorite. You know, we love being there. It's so beautiful.
It's the off season too. I mean, I know you love to cook and be engaged in all that, but it must be nice to just take a deep breath and relax.
Sit by the fire with the dogs.
Yeah.
Yeah. We tend to do more of our hiking and walking in the wintertime, you know, because we have time and we have our favorite places we like to visit in the monument. It's such a precious place, and really, like, I think in the world, you know, our most precious resource by far is our wilderness and our public lands, and we need to really stand up for them, because I want, you know, I want our children's grandchildren to be able to continue to avail themselves of what's there, you know, which is a genuine wilderness experience, a quiet use experience where you can go walking and not encounter another person, and you can have your dog with you, and you can camp, and you can really access quiet, which is something that we don't place enough value on in our culture. Quiet is really nourishing for the soul. So in the winter, what we get to have is quiet, and it restores and rejuvenates and reconnects us to our souls.
That's Blake Spaulding along with Jen Castle. They're chefs and owners of Hell's Backbone Grill and Farm. They have a new cookbook. It's sold out for now. More copies coming in February. It's called This Immeasurable Place, Food and Farming from the Edge of the Wilderness. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Doug.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. We have technical direction from Michael Havey. Our thanks to Anthony Scoma. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.